what happened last week was the most alarming thing I've seen in the money markets for some time. If those treasuries, let's call them $3 trillion, are not funded tonight, the whole system collapses, literally.
I'm a big fan of consolidation in Bitcoin. Well, it's just compressing in volatility. And that's a sign of it maturing. And the more compressed the volatility is, the less likelihood of an 80% decline. As more money is created into the system and flowing around the world, Bitcoin becomes a really valuable collateral as time continues to pass.
Nick Bhatia.
We're back. Back on the show. Things are getting pretty wonky out there at the moment. You did a video last week on the repo market, and you were kind of saying this could be signaling a bit of a crisis in the market. So do you want to explain what's going on? Because this is the world that I don't follow super closely.
Sure. I would love to get into what happened last week, but let me, before that, Danny, just tell you and your audience that I'm a rates analyst and I used to trade rates. I used to trade repo. One of the things that I like to do is look for problems, but be really hesitant to call anything a crisis or to put up these big alarm bells on, you know, a recession is coming or a crash is coming or a crisis is coming. So when I do actually get cautious, it's not that common, okay? And I also still want to say that I'm not calling for a crisis. So before we get into it, what happened last week was the most alarming thing I've seen in the money markets for some time. So I decided to make a video that was dedicated to it. Now, what happened? We can start directly with this chart that I sent you. This slide compares the two rates that I think are the most relevant to my video last week. You can see the spike that happened. Today, we are at 0.01 on this spread. So basically a spread of nil. This is recorded on Tuesday, October 21st. Now, on Thursday of last week, this spread blew out to 14 basis points. And when I say blow out, again, it's material and warranted a video. What this spread, it represents the difference between the repo rate and the risk-free rate. So in this situation, the risk-free rate is the green line, which is interest on reserve balances. This is the rate that, say, JP Morgan has their reserves. This is their deposit account at the Fed. Fed reserves, the line item on the Fed's side of the balance sheet is $3 trillion right now. So on that $3 trillion, the Fed is paying all these banks 4.15% annualized interest rate. The orange line is the SOFR rate, which is a market-derived rate, a repo rate. You can think of it as the average repo rate that money market funds are making by funding dealer balance sheets and other banks with treasury collateral. So the spread represents the pickup, the yield pickup that a bank can get by letting go of reserves and funding a repo transaction. Basically, being the investor in the repo market. So lending the money and receiving the rate. So when the spread is going up, it means that banks that hold reserves, even though they can get a 14 basis point pickup in the repo market, they're still not lending the reserves. Hence, there is reserve scarcity. And I'll pause there because that's the main takeaway from last week. And you can see that, yes, in the Monday and Tuesday time series, the spread came back down.
Okay, so I kind of want to go back a little bit here. So you're saying that we were at a point here where banks were unwilling to lend out their reserves. But Can we talk about why they do that anyway? Like in normal market dynamics, why are banks lending out their reserves for this overnight rate?
It's a good question. It's all about yield, Danny. So in the end, the 4.15% IORB is meant to be a floor. So why don't you pull up the slide 2 here in this pack? This is the corridor. So the Fed controls these flat lines. The zigzaggy lines are repo rates that are market transaction rates. But the flat lines are the Fed's policy rate. So you can see here, it's the purple line, the 4.15, the interest on reserve balances. That's a rate that the Fed has as a floor, meaning that, hey, banks, I will pay you 4.15%, so don't go lending your money to anybody at lower than 4.15. Don't go lending to somebody, a bank at 4.05. I'm paying you 4.15, and I'm the Fed. So in that way, it's a floor.
So I guess there's a few things I want to know in there. So one, when we talk about like the Fed raising or cutting rates, which of these are we talking about? The Fed funds rate?
No. That's the key. The Fed funds rate, and which is the green line, and the repo rates are what they're trying to control. What they actually lower are the reverse repo rate, which now the facility isn't being used. That's a floor. They lower IORB, which is also a floor. They lower the discount rate, which is a ceiling. They lower the rate on the standing repo facility, which isn't pictured in this chart, but it's another ceiling. And so they're raising ceilings and floors because, remember, I explained the floor, right? The interest on reserve balances. What about the ceiling? Hey, that's the red line. I will let you borrow from me at 4.25 if you post good collateral to the discount window. So don't you dare go borrow from somebody at 4.35. I'm the Fed. I will lend to you at 4.25. So that's the ceiling. So they move the ceiling and the floor down. And then what they're doing is they're guiding the Fed funds rate and the repo rate lower. Now, I want to point out one thing quickly, Danny, before we get to the next question, which is that you see how the green line at the current moment is creeping up and it's not flat.
Yeah.
But in the previous interest rate zones, it was flat.
Yep.
So that's exactly the point here. And the 4.11% Fed funds rate, it is a rate that is based off of transactions. It's not the Fed's policy ceiling or floor. And so the Fed funds rate is calculated by what is the rate at which banks are lending to each other. You ask an important question, which is it the Fed funds rate that they're moving? No, they're moving the interest on reserve balances and the discount rate, the standing repo rate and the reverse repo rate. Those are the rates that they move and they guide rates down. So the observation about Fed funds ticking up right now means that, hey, there is some dynamic in the market now where there's a little bit of reserve scarcity and this rate, it is going up in the transactions, banks lending reserves to each other. You know, Fed cares about largely is going to be these repo rates and to make sure that those are also inside the corridor. They don't want them above the corridor. It means that their ceilings aren't working.
Do you wish you could access cash without selling your Bitcoin? Well, Ledger makes that possible. They're the global leader in Bitcoin-backed lending, and since 2018, they've issued over $9 billion in loans with a perfect record of protecting client assets. With Ledger, you get full custody loans with no credit checks or monthly repayments, just easy access to dollars without selling a single sat. As of July 1st, Ledger is Bitcoin only, meaning they exclusively offer Bitcoin-backed loans with all collateral held by Ledger directly or their funding partners. Your Bitcoin is never lent out to generate interest. I recently took out a loan with Ledin. The whole process was super easy. The application took me less than 15 minutes, and in a few hours, I had the dollars in my account. It was really smooth. So if you need cash, but you don't want to sell Bitcoin, head over to ledin.io/WBD and you'll get 0.25% off your first loan. That's ledin.io/WBD. This episode is brought to you by River, and they've just launched a very cool new product where you can automatically buy every price dip. Their zero fee recurring buys are a proven way to build wealth with Bitcoin, and you can now supercharge them and buy up to 100% more Bitcoin if the price is dipping at the time of your order. It's a great tool to buy more Bitcoin at lower prices, and while your cash is waiting to be deployed, you earn 3.75% interest on it paid in Bitcoin. River is built to last with security at its core and is the only Bitcoin exchange in the US with proof of reserves. To open an account, go to river.com/WBD and earn up to $100 in Bitcoin when you buy. That's river.com/WBD. What if you could lower your tax bill and stack Bitcoin at the same time? Well, by mining Bitcoin with Blockware, you can. New tax guidelines from the Big Beautiful Bill allow American miners to write off 100% of the cost of their mining hardware in a single tax year. That's right, 100% write-off. So if you have $100,000 in capital gains or income, you can purchase $100,000 of miners and offset it entirely. Blockware's mining as a service enables you to start mining Bitcoin right now without lifting a finger. Blockware handles everything from securing the miners to sourcing low-cost power to configuring the pool. They do it all. You get to stack Bitcoin at a discount every single day while also saving big come tax season. Get started today by going to mining.blockwaresolutions.com/WBD. Of course, none of this is tax advice. Speak to your accountant or tax advisor to understand how these rules apply to you. And then head over to mining.blockwaresolutions.com/WBD and you'll get 1 week of free hosting and electricity with each hosted miner purchased. Okay, so on this chart, there's a few times when it has spiked above the corridor, and one that really stands out would be September last year, where it had a huge spike above it. What's happening there? What's driving that above the ceiling?
That's the answer to the question also, what happened last week? In repo, it's almost always the same answer, which is the calendar. So the calendar means that on month end, year quarter end, and on year end, and on tax days, big movement in reserve balances, big movement in payments. Tax days meaning, you know, large checks are written, large bank transfers are sent from the banking system through the Federal Reserve into the TGA, which is the Treasury General Account. And then window dressing around month end, which is that banks have to borrow funds to make sure that all of their treasury positions are funded in the market. This is what causes the repo rate to go above the corridor. It's basically, it's going to be either a calendar event or a tax day event, which is also a calendar event. That is all, it's almost always the answer, Danny. So if, you know, in my episode last week, I said, hey, repo desks are saying that this might be a mid-month roll calendar issue triggered by October 15th. Even though rates came back down, right? We saw the spread is now down to 1 basis point from 14 basis points. Even though it came back down, I am not fully buying this mid-month roll explanation for the current spike. I think that there is some reserve scarcity that is developing in the repo market. Powell has actually admitted this, so I'm not necessarily speculating there. But the answer to your question is always going to be month end, quarter end, tax day.
So one of the reasons that I was really interested when I saw this video is when the repo market gets dysfunctional, it's sometimes... it's almost like foreseeing something that's about to come in the market. And I remember back in 2019, the very end of 2019, we did a show on the previous What Bitcoin Did with Caitlin Long and Travis Kling. And they were basically saying something's just blown up and this can't be sustained. And then, I mean, I'm not conspiracy theorist enough to say COVID then happened because of that, but it like almost called the black swan of COVID, and it said that something wasn't sustainable in the market. Is that why you pay such close attention to this for reasons like that?
Yes, the sensitivity of the Fed to problems in the funding market, which are treasury problems, right? The Fed always responds when there's a problem in the treasury market. So the repo market is the treasury market. That's, people need to understand that, that the repo market exists because you have this huge, basically multi-trillion dollar tranche of treasuries at all times that is not in the final investor's hands. It's this interim pool of treasuries that haven't gone to their ultimate investor yet. And if that number is several trillion dollars, which it is today, Danny, I mean, the SOFR volumes are 3 trillion. It means there's at least 3 trillion of them that need to be funded every night. 3 on 38. So, and I would suggest that it's closer to 5, 7, 9 trillion dollars of treasuries that are always kind of at any point looking for some funding. There are only $7 trillion in money market funds. So it's not like there's an unlimited pool of capital to fund these interim treasuries. That's why the repo market is so important, is that if those treasuries, let's call them $3 trillion, are not funded tonight, the whole system collapses, literally. So the Fed can't afford anything like that to happen. And yes, you do have to go back to September 2019 because it's an important moment in money market history, and the standing repo facility exists today. The Fed realized that they didn't have a ceiling. They didn't have an effective ceiling. Now they have the standing repo facility. So what we've been waiting for the whole time since 2019 is the point at which we get to test the standing repo facility. And that's one of the things that alarmed me last week, is that, wait a second, why are participants starting to use the standing repo facility? And I checked this morning, there was another $3 billion in usage. These are not massive numbers, but somebody is struggling at the margin. The Fed funds market, if you go to the Fed funds, the New York Fed website, and you look at the Fed funds webpage, what you actually see is all the transactions on a curve. They show you where most of them get done, and then they show you the 75th percentile and the 99th percentile. And you can see that 99th percentile means the edge of the system is paying 4.18, not 4.11, which you see on your screen there in green. It's 4.18. The standing repo facility, somebody said, I need $3 billion today. So these are not crisis numbers, but they are like, it's time to pay attention more than ever to the repo market, because this is the moment we've been waiting for to test SRF, standing repo facility. We're getting the test. It's a baby test, but it's non-zero.
Okay. I want to just go back a little bit, because I want to understand this better, because the repo market and the reverse repo market has been explained to me so many times, but I still struggle with it. So just help me understand, if all these banks are sat on a ton of reserves, which is their collateral, what drives them to use the repo facility overnight? Why don't they just sit on that collateral? Is it just to try and chase like the tiny little bit of yield they can get on it, because it's such a large amount, it's sort of meaningful?
Okay, you're going to have to ask it one more time, because I'm going to answer one thing that you set up for me there, which is that reserves are not there. You can think of them as collateral, but it's the wrong way to think of them. Collateral is fungible in that you can post it elsewhere, like outside the system, for example, or to some other party. Reserves are not, they can't move them. You can convert them into assets like treasuries and things like that, but reserves are not collateral for the banks. They are a tool for interbank settlement in the onshore system. So they need reserves to do business, like regular business, to settle checks and wires. including the purchase of treasuries. So sending money to the TGA, you have to have reserves to do it. Because a swap for the Fed, they debit the reserves and they credit the TGA when you buy treasuries. So now I'll please ask you to ask your question again, but it's an important differentiator there.
Okay, so I think possibly you've answered that question in that they can't just sit on them because they actually have to use them for the operations of the bank. But is that the reason that they have to go to these repo facilities? Because they might be either short on reserves, or they have excess reserves and can just make a little bit of money overnight on them?
No, the treasuries that they need, that they rely on the repo market for, are separate from reserves. So
okay.
Think of two types of financial institutions. You have a dealer and you have a bank. JP Morgan is the bank. They have $1 trillion of reserves sitting at the Fed. JP Morgan Chase has their dealer also. And the dealer has, let's say, $100 billion in treasuries on its balance sheet. So the dealer needs $100 billion in cash from the repo market to see the next day. As Perry Merling says, repo is how you live to fight another day. Well, they have $100 billion in assets. They need $100 billion in cash to fund that overnight. So every night they're in the repo market trying to get that $100 billion so that they can have the inventory of $100 billion in treasuries so they can traffic, buy and sell, and make money. That's the dealer. JP Morgan, the bank, has $1 trillion in reserves, and it has, you know, tens of millions of clients around the country. Those clients are sending wires to each other. They're sending wires to customers of Citibank. So JP Morgan, the bank, needs reserves so that when, you know, let's say NVIDIA banks at JP Morgan and Sam Altman banks at Citi, and it's time for NVIDIA to pay OpenAI for something, and they send $1 billion to OpenAI, JP Morgan has to send $1 billion in reserves to Citi. So they need that money for their operation. So the bank needing reserves for its operations is a completely separate dynamic than a dealer that has treasuries and needs cash tonight. Who's the provider of the cash, Danny? It's the money market funds. My seat where I used to be, where I have, you know, I'm a fiduciary for corporations and governments, and I have, billions of dollars in short-term cash, and I have to decide what to do with it. JP Morgan, the dealer, says, hey, I'll pay you 4.16% overnight, secured by treasury collateral. Can I borrow from you? And then the money market fund lends to the dealer. So they are a little bit separate issues that we're talking about. Does that help?
Yeah, that does help. So then I want to go back to that first chart you brought up, because the spike that you were talking about last week, I think I understand now. That's the dealer going to the repo market and JP Morgan or whoever not being willing to part with their reserves until the price was higher.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And so that's signaling that they feel, what, a lack of confidence in the market that they can actually part with those reserves.
And that's the key. It's why they're not parting with it. That's the key. So my theory here is that the percentage, the reserves as a percentage of GDP is falling to a more dangerous level, because reserves are used for banking activity, as we're explaining, wires from JP Morgan to Citi and back. The larger the economy grows, the more reserves you need inside the system to allow people to send wires to each other. Big banking deals, bond deals, even treasury auctions are important to throw into that. So the larger the treasury auctions and the larger the economy, the larger the deficit, you just need more reserves so that Jamie can say, I'll lend you my reserves. or I'll pull out reserves and put them in the repo market tonight. So my big theory here is that we're at a point, yes, the Fed's balance sheet is declining and reserves have started to trickle down now that reverse repo is gone. As reserves decline, there's a mathematical minimum to a healthy amount of reserves to let the money market function. And that's where I think we are. So the answer to your question, why wouldn't they do it, is basically they realize we're at the point that they need to just hold on to it, even if they're being offered 14 basis points pickup. It's not worth it to them because they're risk managers first. They're arbitrageurs second, but they have to make sure their bank wakes up the next day. And holding on to your reserves is sometimes better for your health as a bank than picking up that extra 14 basis points for one night. And remember, it's 14 basis points divided by 365. I mean, it's pennies, right? But the banks do it. That's how they squeeze every penny out of, you know, in arbitrage. But at a certain point, they don't do it because health and safety, risk management, and PTSD also. 2019 PTSD, and honestly, the banking system is still, you know, in a 16-year hangover from the financial crisis. So there's a lot of PTSD in the system.
I don't know why. Like, this is obviously really in the kind of financial plumbings of how banking works, but this element of like macro is the bit that I find the hardest to understand. And I don't know why it is. It doesn't seem like very intuitive to me. But obviously you've spent years and years and years working in this and living in this. So is this the most important thing to watch right now? And do you think it's actually showing signs that QT might be over and QE is about to start?
So QE is going to be relative because they might call it something else. The point is that I do believe that reserves do need to be introduced back into the system. So that's the mechanism will be QE-like. I do believe that QT does have to end because of the mechanics of this that we're talking about. Is it the most important thing to watch in the system? You know, that's a lot of the answer to that is actually, do you think that the Fed is the most important actor right now in the global macro economy? And I would argue no, because I don't think that the response is going to be more liquidity creating than what I do expect is going to be happening in the private sector. So there's some worrying stuff in the money market that's going to put the Fed back in play. It's going to make them have to end QT. It's going to make them have to increase their balance sheet. I've said for a while that I believe it'll be, they'll call it something like nominal GDP targeting, you know, for the balance sheet. Like the balance sheet will now follow GDP targeting, something like that, where they don't have to call it QE. They can call it something else. We'll know what it is. You know, it's balance sheet expansion. But QE are these. They used to call it LSAP, large scale asset purchases. The LSAP days, I don't see that happening right now. We could get LSAP in the future. You get this huge balance sheet expansion, but that's not really what I see. I actually see balance sheet expansion in the private sector. I'll point people to the JP Morgan announcement of $1.5 trillion in funding that they are planning for 27 key American industries to rebuild America's competitiveness on a technology, defense, mining front. That's where I believe liquidity will be created. So is it the most important thing, Danny, that, you know, we should all be watching on the macro side? it's not actually. The CapEx boom that we that has already started and we're witnessing is the more important macro story. I believe the standing repo facility plus Jerome Powell are capable of negating a repo crisis, avoiding large-scale asset purchases, and introducing liquidity in a more gentle way through the Fed that would make it not the most important thing.
Okay, I've got like five questions in that, but I'm going to try and keep us on track here before we get onto the private sector stuff. If they do a kind of GDP-denominated expansion of the balance sheet, is that sustainable? Can they do that for a long time? Or like just with the way the system's designed, does it need those huge expansions every now and again?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it comes down to how much the U.S. government needs to rely on the Fed. So at the moment, or let's say during 2020, 2021, the government was entirely reliant on the Fed to finance the CARES Act and emergency response. Entirely reliant. There was no private sector capacity to absorb that type of fiscal deficit. No capacity. So the Fed and the government teamed up. There's a way to categorize what the government did as pinning the Fed into the QE. Like, you know, we're going to spend $9 trillion and you can't do anything about it. You're just going to have to do trillions of QE. And they did. So the balance sheet expansion that they did back then was warranted by fiscal activity. So your question is, can they just do baby increases? Well, if the government is able to reduce its fiscal deficit from where it was at 7 to now it's under 6, if they're able to get it to under 5, et cetera, keep going, then perhaps yes. If there's no financial crisis, that the Treasury Department goes and bails out banks like what happened in 2008 and 2009, that required LSAP because you take on the debt of the banks, basically. You inject liquidity, means what? The government borrows, issues treasuries, and then sends the money into the banking system and recapitalizes the banks. Well, who's gonna fund the treasuries that they had to issue? They had to borrow the money from somewhere. You get LSAP. So the LSAP, the large scale asset purchases, are triggered by the government spending the money. If we really look at the history of it. Now, the LSAP that happened in 2010, 2012, which is that QE2, QE3, and the LSAP that happened in late 2021, which was not emergency, right? COVID was already, the emergency itself was already a year and a half in the rear view, and they kept going. Those are the ones where you say those were unnecessary or you didn't need to do that. So you will need QT eventually because you went too far. So I hope that answers your question. I don't think it needs to come with the large scale unless the government does something. And I'm quite bullish on the United States private sector over the next coming years, which might reduce the marginal or might reduce the deficit as a percentage of GDP at the margin, right? We're at 5.9% today. You know, I believe that could creep down and put any risk of the Fed having to come in and do these large-scale QEs maybe maybe punt it down. And I could be completely wrong, or I could be right and just not see that a crisis is maybe 3 or 6 months around the corner, and then the government comes in and has to bail out a sector that we might not even think of right now, and then have to borrow, and the Fed has to do QE to join in.
What Bitcoin Did is brought to you by the massive legends Iron, the largest NASDAQ-listed Bitcoin miner using 100% renewable energy. Iron are not just powering the Bitcoin network, they're also providing cutting-edge computing resources for AI, all backed by renewable energy. We've been working with their founders, Dan and Will, for quite some time now and have been really impressed with their values, especially their commitment to local communities and sustainable computing power. So whether you're interested in mining Bitcoin or harnessing AI compute power, Iron is setting the standard. Visit iron.com to learn more, which is iren.com. If you already self-custody your Bitcoin, you know the deal with hardware wallets. Complex setups, clumsy interfaces, and a seed phrase that can be lost, stolen, or forgotten. Well, BitKey fixes that. BitKey is a multi-sig hardware wallet built by the team behind Square and Cash App. It packs a cryptographic recovery system and built-in inheritance feature into an intuitive, easy-to-use wallet with no seed phrase to sweat over. It's simple, secure self-custody without the stress. And Time named BitKey one of the best inventions of 2024. Get 20% off at bitkey.world when you use the code WBD. That's bitkey.world and use the code WBD. This episode is brought to you by AnchorWatch. The thing that keeps me up at night is the idea of a critical error with my Bitcoin cold storage. And this is where AnchorWatch comes in. With AnchorWatch, your Bitcoin is insured with your own A-plus rated Lloyd's of London insurance policy, and all Bitcoin is held in their time-locked multi-sig vaults. So you have the peace of mind knowing your Bitcoin is insured while not giving up custody. So whether you're worried about inheritance planning, rent tax, natural disasters, or just your own silly mistakes, you're protected by AnchorWatch. Rates for fully insured custody start as low as 0.55% and are available for individual and commercial customers located in the US. Speak to AnchorWatch for a quote and for more details about your security options and coverage. Visit AnchorWatch.com today. That is AnchorWatch.com. I love Larry Lepard. He's on the show fairly regularly. His book is brilliant. And he always talks about this idea of like the big print coming. And he doesn't put a time frame on it. He's not saying that it's going to happen tomorrow, but he's saying just the way the system is set up, it has to happen at some point. Do you think he is missing something there?
It's not that he's missing something. It's just that I don't agree with the Fed print has to happen. I think that the whole system is in a state of flux, and it's responding to unsustainable paths that it might have been on. So I believe much more in the self-correcting as opposed to the big print to just inflate everything away. Again, it probably comes back to my bullishness on the US productivity and private sector, in that I just don't see the big print being inevitable in the same way he does. Now, Larry is a brilliant historian in the way that he set up the history of the United States financial system and the different periods in which sound money was the basis of the system, and the days in which the fractional system was more controlled or better controlled, or more perhaps the free banking system was a more free market system, but prone to crisis too. So, you know, one can like another's history and context, but completely disagree with, you know, the result. And Larry and I have had great conversations. We even were on stage together in Vegas and discussed some of it. But I read his book before we did the panel because I always like to learn about American financial history, and there were some great nuggets that I picked up there. I think that as a trader, a former trader of U.S. Treasuries, I can see how strong the asset class is. So this idea that the asset class itself is on weak footing is something that I wholly disagree with. And again, it's not that today it's just a great asset class. The government has to get its act together for it to be a great asset class for another 20 years, right? So maybe that's the disagreement, is that my my outlook is more bullish than his on the U.S. government's ability to have a sustainable deficit, a sustainable debt, grow the private sector, have the right taxes and regulations to have a sustainable debt to GDP ratio that allows the government and the private sector to both prosper. So that would be my thought on the big print.
Yeah, I can understand that viewpoint. And I've spoken to Joe Calisseri on this, and it sounds like you probably agree with Joe on a lot of these takes, because he's also like a big believer in the productivity. And the thing that I always struggle with there is I can believe that the US becomes far more productive. I think automation, robotics, like AI, all this stuff is going to have a massive boon. But what I don't know is what that does to jobs. Like, I don't know if AI, like the number of jobs that AI will replace, but I think it's going to be really high. And if the US has like positive GDP growth while joblessness is going up, what happens then?
It's a good question. There is a dynamic at play already, Danny, in which the S&P 500 is going up, but job openings are going down.
Mm-hmm.
So we're already living in this era. Like it's in front of us. So if we're already living through an era in which job openings are going down, and anecdotally too, we hear about, you know, it being tough to get a job for entry-level people, for example, but the stock market's going up and GDP is doing fine, what is the sensitivity of US GDP to the middle, you know, the middle of jobs, the middle income area of jobs, or the lower income area of jobs? It might be zero. Right? What is the sensitivity, right? That's always what we're thinking about. Yes, the labor market might be an issue. Yes, AI might replace a lot of American jobs. But how much does aggregate consumption go down if that's the case? And aggregate consumption is 70% of US GDP, so it's the main driver. So if people are losing their jobs due to AI, but aggregate consumption goes up 3%, then there's no more sensitivity to, I shouldn't say no more, but there's no sensitivity to this particular dynamic. Now, what if it continues and starts to wipe out enough jobs so that it hits aggregate consumption and then hits GDP and tax revenue and all that kind of stuff? I mean, that's not my base case at all. Now, I'm looking at how is AI going to replace jobs and hit the economy and the labor force, and how does that feed back into consumption in the US GDP? Okay, but what is GDP? If you go back to econ textbooks, GDP equals consumption plus government spending plus savings, and then the export factor, the net export. So throw out net exports for a second. So you have the consumer and the government. Let's say the government doesn't spend more money, because we don't really want it to if we're in this bullish American thesis where we want sustainable debt to GDP. We don't want the government spending more and more money or increasing as a percentage of GDP. We don't want that. Now in the Econ 101, your whole income is either consumed or spent. There's nothing else to do with it mathematically. You only have two choices. You either spend it or you save it. Now you zoom into savings. Econ 101 suggests that savings equals investment. S equals I. It means that if you save a dollar, by default, you are investing it. Now you can invest it in a T-bill or you can build a factory. My bet is that all of the consumption that is not spent, basically all the money that is not spent in a previous regime, let's say the last 20 years, it's saved and hoarded and sent treasury yields lower, but not anymore. were on the upswing of the, you know, of yields. And I'm not a big believer in this big bond bear market, but the era of zero rates is over. You have healthy rates now. And that healthy interest rate in the market is not enough to say to people, hide out in T-bills. We're going to go build a factory. And that's where a lot of my bullishness comes from, is that it's the factory building. I did a video just today, Jensen Huang, he's talking about, the CEO of NVIDIA, he's talking about the United States building thousands of factories and using millions of skilled workers to do it. It's a very bullish vision. Where's the capital going to come from? Where's the labor, the skill, all of that? That's TBD, right? I don't have blinders on and, you know, just think we can build 1,000 factories tomorrow. But they already built the fastest chip in the world, from my understanding, in the United States this year already. And he's on TV talking about it and attributing almost everything to President Donald Trump and his efforts and the tariffs specifically. That's wild. It's actually way more accelerated of a timeline than I expected. That you can go from a new president to tariff policy to the fastest chip ever made already in United States, done, manufactured. Where, that's what, you asked me what's the most important. That's the most important story. It's these next 1,000 factories and the build out of tens of trillions in AI infrastructure, which includes energy grid, electrification, and all of that. And by the way, is it going to be all government financed? No. Part of my bullishness is that JP Morgan releases $1.5 trillion dedicated to these 27 key industries. And it includes 6G, mesh networks, drones, robotics, mining for all the material, space exploration. So this is a wealth and credit creation and money. It's very fleeting. That's why people love Bitcoin and they love gold. It's more tangible. They can feel the numbers. They can feel the metal. Real estate also very popular, but JP Morgan and its cohorts, Danny, could create $30 trillion in loans over the next decade. Profit off of every one of them, and the United States could end up with thousands of new factories and industries that are world leading. And it could lead to the importing of skilled labor, where education is sourced and skills are sourced from around the world. And you have two decades of American prosperity in just the building out of it, and not even the benefits that could come from the build out. So this is me being, you know, very patriotic, bullish about the future of the country, of course. But the point here is that it's not the government itself that needs to spend the money. JP Morgan can create it out of thin air. Citi can create it out of thin air. They've been doing it for hundreds of years. And with a new regime, which if anybody is paying attention, you can see we're in a new global order, whether it's a global trade order, a political order, the death of globalism, the revitalization of nationalism, the return of the sovereign, the end of the UN, whatever you want to call it, this era could unleash bank credit creation in a way that we've never witnessed. That's the biggest story to me. It's a Bitcoin story too, if people know where to find it.
So with JP Morgan, you're saying they want to create $1.5 trillion. How can they even do that? Like, I understand like loaning money into existence and like credit creation, but like, how do they do that while in a sustainable way for their balance sheet?
they make loans that they know that the customers can pay back. So that's all it comes down to. If they lend money for a 10-year project, the payback has to, the participant, the borrower, has to go out, build a factory and sell goods, you know, products and services, and then pay back the loan. So how can they do it? Well, there's two answers to your question. Number one, the changes in regulation are key in this. And there's two components. Number, the first regulation change they need is the elimination of this penalty for holding treasury capital. Basically, they should be able to hold treasuries without any capital charge on their balance sheet. That's one thing. The other thing are just the actual lending standards that are being, I mean, they're overly restrictive, and it's one of the things that Treasury Bessent wants to unwind are some of these overly restrictive regulations on lending. So if you get some good banking deregulation, you get the treasuries off of the penalty. It's called the SLR, the supplemental leverage ratio. If you eliminate that penalty on holding treasuries, you automatically unlock lending. There are numbers that Goldman and Merrill did studies on this, where if you eliminate that charge, you automatically allow, within the current banking regulations, a couple trillion in lending. I think it was somewhere in the $2 to $4 trillion that gets unlocked. I mean, overnight from one regulatory change. So those are the regulatory changes. So that's one place the capital can come from. But another place the capital can come from is out of these instruments that these entities hold that are for safety. Okay, enough with the safety. It's time to invest. Remember, S equals I. So it's either S or it's I. So it's turn the S into I, go invest the capital. There is equity all around the world. And that's existing capital. It's not fresh credit creation. But if you get that capital out of a hoarder's mentality and you put it into bank equity, you can go leverage it again. So if these banks can boost their equity positions, it's the basis for more and more. Lending is fractional. So the answer to your question, actually, it's you unleash the fractional reserve. How do you do that? You have to have regulations go your way. And if you can get some new capital in there, you can really do it. But it's a behavioral thing. I think it's a behavioral thing first, that they just have to get into that mentality that, okay, we're going to go out and make these loans. And they're hitting the tape with, you know, 1.5 trillion. And they say, oh yeah, we're, you know, 10 billion in equity too, which is good. You know, they're actually going to take stakes, but it's the lending that is material.
And if all this capital does get unlocked and we have trillions of dollars from the private sector created for these businesses, what impact does that have on inflation when it's coming from the private sector rather than from the government?
The same. And because it's a raise, it's an increase in aggregate demand, right? Because when consumption and investment go up, or let's say investment goes up and consumption goes down, but investment is going up, that is a purchase of materials, labor, and it sends money, all, you know, credit creation that comes from the private sector sends money into the economy. So, you know, you ask the right follow-up, which is what's the take on inflation? The take on inflation is that it'll be sustained. It will be sustained. I'm not a big believer in this 5 to 10% inflation on the broad level, but on a more zoomed level, there will be sectors that will experience this type of inflation throughout this entire CapEx boom, if that's what we are to see. And the bond market right now says that number is, you know, in the 2 to 2.5% range. You know, that might be a little low, but I'm not into the, I don't believe that double digit inflation is going to be the result of the CapEx boom, especially with the productivity gains and maybe driving down the labor cost as well. The government, by the way, will need more of a social safety net if AI really does just shatter the labor force and replace so many jobs. You know,
that's where you need UBI or something similar.
Transfer payments and all of that kind of stuff. It should be near people's base case for the next couple decades. If we're in these new regimes, expecting something like that, but it would have to be sustainable for my stability of the treasury market thesis to play out.
See, I could be being naive here, but I can't see a world where, if AI does what I think it's going to do and what a lot of people think it's going to do, I can't see a world where we don't have QE. And that's going to be a serious increase in the balance sheet going forward as well.
You know, QE has to be triggered by some sort of crisis. So if the crisis is 1% increase in unemployment every 3 to 6 months, is there a bailout package that needs to be sent to every citizen in the United States? And if that's the case, then yes, I would agree with you that it's going to come along with some balance sheet expansion. But I don't think it can be triggered without some big spending package or some big financial crisis.
It seems like the future we're going into is just more and more wealth inequality as well.
There's no doubt about that, especially with what we're talking about with the stock market going up and job openings going down. And even the premise that a poor labor market doesn't affect aggregate consumption. That screams wealth inequality.
It's a little bit of a scary future. But if we like to summarize your point, do you think sort of QT is probably coming to an end, maybe ending? QE in some form might be coming back, even if it's sort of GDP denominated. There's going to be a massive private credit boom. What does all this mean for Bitcoin?
Yes, Bitcoin now, I believe, is the way that we've been thinking about it is a liquidity asset. Mm-hmm. So as liquidity comes into the system, Bitcoin is the recipient of some of that. When liquidity tightens up, we see Bitcoin's price suffer. So if Bitcoin is receiving a passive flow from all credit expansion dynamics, and it is a superior asset to other assets in terms of the relative catch-up, then Bitcoin should perform very well, especially as more money is created into the system and flowing around the world. Bitcoin becomes a really valuable collateral as time continues to pass. So the thesis on Bitcoin is very bullish. And if we think about what are the big risks for Bitcoin going forward, I would say credit contraction is probably the biggest risk. But we live in this world that where credit contraction is responded to by bailouts, which are backed by QE. And that world is, we're going to have to see some dramatic event to have to change our thesis, right? It doesn't feel like it's the right thesis to say, well, there will be, you know, I'm sure that there'll be credit losses somewhere, and then the government is going to let all the banks fail and a big contraction of the credit system. The government, you know, it won't be there, and the Fed won't be there either to backstop it. Big destruction in credit. Big destruction in stock prices, Bitcoin, dollar soars, and that's the risk. There's another risk, which is separate than that, which is that inflation gets out of hand and interest rates have to go way up, or the market drives them up because the market is saying, hey, inflation's at 6-7%. I'm pulling my money out and putting it in fixed income, pulling it out of risk, and liquidity is affected through a big bear market in treasuries because of inflation getting out of hand. I would say that that's a risk to Bitcoin. Bitcoin is not, I don't believe, ready to act as an inflation hedge in that example. In a big bear market in treasuries, Bitcoin isn't going to do great. You can look at 2022 for a good example of that. And I still believe that dynamic is there. So in the absence of a big wave of inflation or a big contraction in credit that isn't responded to by policy bailouts, I think Bitcoin does very well in this middle ground of big capex, passive flows from spending incomes, and even if it is only a certain portion of the economy that is earning in an AI world, that some of that money ends up in Bitcoin as well.
Why don't you think Bitcoin's ready to behave as an inflation hedge? Because, like, I think we both probably agree that kind of is what it is and what it will be in the future. But why do you think it's not ready now? What is it that makes sort of gold able to do that, but not Bitcoin yet?
I don't even think gold is the inflation hedge. So when it comes down to looking at the statistics, the correlations, the drivers, gold has had an incredible year with inflation being totally stable around 2.9, 3, 2.8. I mean, trending down, trending flat, no real tariff scare. Gold is just ripping.
Uh-huh.
So gold is not ripping as an inflation hedge this year. It's ripping. We can talk about that, but it's ripping for other geopolitical reasons. It's not ripping because people are dumping treasuries. Treasuries are trading very well this year. So I don't think gold is functioning as an inflation hedge. This year's price action tells me that gold is performing well in the absence of inflation, especially with the economy being in that kind of so-so area, rates trending down. Remember, rates trending down means lower inflation expectations going forward. So why isn't Bitcoin ready to trade as an inflation hedge? Because the market shows us that when volatility spikes on a pop in interest rates off of an inflation scare, the Bitcoin doesn't do well. It goes down.
So the market's just still treating it like a risk asset.
It just is. It's treating it like a liquidity asset.
We should talk about gold, because I saw in that recent video you were kind of alarmed at gold's performance and you weren't really sure why it was happening. Checkmate, who, good friend of mine, I know you know him well as well, he talks about gold as it's kind of showing us the path and Bitcoin sort of follows. Why are you nervous about what gold is doing?
So let me specify the word nervous, I guess, in this context. First of all, I traded gold back in the day as a hobbyist, not a professional. Traded rates professionally and money markets professionally. So when I give my opinion on these markets, it comes from, you know, former professional practitioner. So I'm not a gold trader in any sort of professional practitioner sort of way. I'm also not a gold researcher either. Now, I am very passionate about geopolitics. I was a former gold bug before finding Bitcoin, a big proponent of sound money before finding Bitcoin and after understanding QE. So that's the context for gold. So why am I nervous about it? I'm nervous because when the gold price, or let's just say the gold price going up the way that it has this year, makes me feel like there's some very large geopolitical move being played. Is it a United States move? Is it a Chinese move? Is there some fear trade associated with a big blow up in Europe, like European QE, ECB QE. These are maybe three of the options. I don't know, and I you know, reading theories, I'm reading some street research on it. Nothing is super convincing to me. My hunch has this, like, the fact that Trump and Besant are absolutely silent on this matter, to me, means that it might be something that's U.S. caused and that benefits the U.S. Because if somebody was doing this, let's say this was China buying and delivering and driving the gold price up, which there's a lot of evidence that gold is getting delivered to the U.S. this year, like U.S. gold delivery. So there's a lot of evidence that this might be American driven. But let's say it was China driving the gold price up. And let's say that the price of gold going up was hurting in some way the U.S., U.S. banks, or the U.S. government in some way, or the Fed or some position. You would see Trump do his thing and, you know, hit the tape and, you know, talk a bunch of smack and blame somebody or something. But we don't see that. And so why am I nervous? I'm nervous when I don't know what's happening. So, and I only have, you know, a limited amount of time, you know, to do research. And it also means that some of the more theoretical, you know, I believe this is happening, Besson is doing this, or this is some squeeze. You know, I'll shout out, you know, some of the street research that I've been reading that's been excellent, some of it out of Merrill and, you know, mostly out of Bank of America. Merrill Lynch wrote some good stuff on this. Nothing has me convinced, because I'm too, you know, conspiratorial minded in thinking about this, that who's getting squeezed and who's getting hurt and who's benefiting from this. That nothing I've read really fits the bill. And the stuff that is more conspiratorial that I maybe want to believe, I can't prove. And so all of the not knowing makes me nervous. And also this hunch that maybe Europe is blowing up and the ECB is setting up for some massive QE, or there's somebody in Europe that's being squeezed, like out of London, maybe the bullion banks or something like that. That has me nervous, because that can come with a big financial crisis, panic, you know, perhaps a sharp fall in risk prices that scares a lot of people, forces liquidations. And the people that are over leveraged, God bless them, but it's the people that actually are not leveraged but still get shaken out of their position that I worry for them. Because that's happened to people, you know, that they get shaken out and then they don't realize that everything is going to get bailed out. So they miss, you know, the pop back. And, you know, we don't know if we're still in a bailout culture or not. We'll never know until you get to the crisis. But I hope that answers your question as to why I feel nervous about the gold price.
My money's on, we still are in a bailout culture. But I mean, I think it's interesting because earlier this year, tons and tons of gold were leaving London coming to America. I don't really know why that was. I think people called it like an arbitrage trade. I don't know if I really buy that. China are the biggest producer of gold. I'm sure they've been stacking a ton of gold over the last year, probably multiple years. So is your worry here that like the US and China might be in almost like a silent war to stack as much gold as possible, and you don't know who's going to come out on top at the end of that?
You know, that's less scary, because that's just an accumulation. So that would be less scary to me. And we do know that China's stacking gold. We have, you know, the Shanghai gold contract volumes are up also. So we know that China's been stacking gold for many years. That's not a surprise. The United States is not admitting to any sort of gold stacking. It has a large gold position, but it would be the private sector banks or whoever that's importing that gold and taking delivery, not necessarily the U.S. government, unless they're doing it covertly or under the table in some way like that. So I don't think that a U.S.-China fight over gold would scare me. When a market goes up this quickly and there's not a lot of explanation, it's like, wow, you know, there really is something going on behind the scenes. And as a macro analyst, it's all fascinating to me, and you're limited by time, and you're also limited by what you want to be well-versed in. I want to be a great rates analyst and a great Bitcoin analyst, but I don't feel that I can be also a great gold analyst. So it leaves it out of, you know, my immediate research purview. And then when something happens in it, I'm caught off guard by the speed at which gold has gone up. And, you know, not knowing is probably bothering me.
Yeah, I get that. It's funny because, like, in previous cycles where Bitcoin's been doing well, you see a ton of retail people turn up, and we've not really had that this cycle. I've not noticed it that much. I think potentially it's starting. Like, I've seen a lot of new listeners on the podcast, but nothing like previous cycles. But then at the same time, I'm sure you've seen the picture of queues outside gold dealerships. And, yep. And like, it seems like the retail FOMO is in gold this time, which is a really interesting dynamic. With everything that's happened over the last couple of weeks in Bitcoin, last time we spoke, you said you were sort of 60-40 on the cycles being broken. Has anything changed now we've seen the sort of sharp drop in Bitcoin and it's looking a little more uneasy?
Yeah, I would say it creeps up every day, that 60-40 number. You know, I don't necessarily feel like I want to put a number that's higher than 60 today on the show, but yeah, I believe with every day that goes by that we're not really beholden to this cycle. I haven't seen any of the FOMO trade in Bitcoin this time around, like you just mentioned. And the cycle that we saw in 2017 and 2021 both had just completely different behavioral patterns. Mm-hmm. And now we're almost, you know, through with October here, and the Bitcoin price just isn't going anywhere. It's still consolidating. I think that's super healthy. I'm a big fan of consolidation in Bitcoin because it means that Bitcoin is not in any, it's just compressing in volatility. And that's a sign of it maturing. And the more compressive volatility is, the less likelihood of an 80% decline. So when I see volatility start to peak up, to pop up like it has in the last couple weeks, you start to wonder, oh, are we, you know, in for one of those big moves? But no, I still believe consistent with our last interview.
All right, Nick, this has been awesome. I mean, the repo stuff, I don't know why it just doesn't fit in my head very well, but this was super useful. I think I learned a lot. It's going to be an interesting time coming up. We've got an interesting sort of 12 months ahead of us. We'll see what happens.
Absolutely. And, you know, the gold weekly candle this week is one of those candles that, you know, the chart analyst in me says, oh, now, you know, the gold run is over. It's going to consolidate maybe for another 6 to 12 months and all that. But I thought that a couple times over this current bull market in gold where I saw a candle and just, you know, a reversal and I said, oh, that's it. And then it keeps going. So, that's one of the things that's the most fascinating thing. And on the repo side, it just takes so much repetition. And I remember just being on the desk and it just takes, you know, months and months and months of reading about it every single day to really understand what's going on. So I appreciate you letting me teach you and others.
No, I appreciate it, Nick. Thank you. And tell everyone where to check out your videos and the newsletter, all the stuff that you do.
Yeah, everything you guys can find at thebitcoinlayer.com. So we have a show channel if you like to watch, listen. We have a great research newsletter. and the links to my books as well. Everything is at thebitcoinlayer.com.
How's the sales on the Bitcoin Age gone?
Oh, it's gone great. I really feel blessed to have so many great readers. And the fun thing about Bitcoin Age is that people are genuinely learning things that they didn't expect to learn. So Bitcoiners that said, oh, I learned this particular thing, and that always makes me excited. I got to teach both of my books together as one product this summer, which was excellent. And I'm going to get to do that again next year.
Love it. I've not got it on the bookshelf yet, Nick, but I'm going to buy it as soon as we get off this call and put it on there. I was waiting for my signed copy, but I'll have to just get two.
Danny, well, I'll send you one. Absolutely.
All right, Nick. Thanks so much for this. It's been great.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.